having us on to talk about this important topic. A $700 electric bill in Puerto Rico, reassignment to custodial jobs, not that there's anything wrong with custodial jobs, but for people the workers who brought back, who helped rebuild the infrastructure after the devastating Hurricane Maria. Puerto Rican Independence Party, Women in Black, Plante Bandera. Where else are you hearing this? You're hearing it here on your radio station, WBAI. Make the call right now, even though Democracy Now! Is coming on, 212-209-2950. Support this program. Support a new day.
That's how much the nine nuclear-armed states spent on nuclear weapons in 2020. Taxpayer money during the worst global pandemic in a century, financing weapons of mass destruction.
As President Biden prepares for the G7 and NATO summits and a meeting with Vladimir Putin, we'll look at how the United States, Russia, and other nuclear-armed nations continue to spend billions on nuclear weapons despite the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll speak to ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. Then, as President Biden pledges to buy 500 million vaccine doses to give to the rest of the world, we'll look at why so many Americans are refusing to get vaccinated.
And if we can galvanize that group that still, for one reason or other, does not want to get vaccinated, we can reach the 70 and go well beyond it as we get into the summer.
We'll speak to Dr. Sarah Madan of New York City Health and Hospitals, the nation's largest public health care system. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's arrived in the United Kingdom for his first overseas trip since taking office. After meeting British Prime Minister Boris Johnson today, Biden will take part in the G7 leaders meeting in Cornwall, then head to the NATO summit in Brussels. He'll end his trip in Geneva, where he'll meet Russian President Vladimir Putin. During his trip, Biden's expected to announce the U.S. will buy 500 million doses of Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine and donate them to 92 lower-income countries. Under the emerging plan, the first 200 million doses would be distributed by the end of this year, the rest by June of 2022. World Trade Organization members have agreed to begin negotiations next week on a temporary waiver of intellectual property rights for coronavirus vaccines. South Africa and India first proposed the patent waivers in October as part of an urgent effort to increase the availability of vaccines in poorer countries. The effort has languished for more than 8 months amidst opposition from drug companies and wealthy WTO members. Since then, the world's recorded over 2.6 million COVID deaths and 140 million new infections. On Wednesday, the Argentine President Alberto Fernandez and the Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said in a joint news conference they support a waiver for COVID vaccine patents. This is Prime Minister Sanchez.
Argentina and Spain are defending the liberation of vaccines, making them a global public good, and consequently speeding up their distribution and increasing their production capacity for the whole of humanity to vaccinate all of our societies as quickly as possible and overcome this calamity that COVID-19 represents.
The Biden administration initially opposed patent waivers for COVID vaccines, then reversed course in May amidst intense pressure from advocacy groups and some Democrats. The European Union and several nations, including the UK and Switzerland, remain opposed. India reported over 6,100 deaths from COVID-19 Thursday, the highest one-day death toll of any nation since the start of the pandemic. The high death tally came because one Indian state reported thousands of previously unreported deaths, adding to evidence that India's vastly undercounted the number of people sickened and killed by the virus. Haiti is experiencing its worst ever surge of COVID cases, with hospitals stretched to their limits. A severe shortage of testing in Haiti is masking the true scale of the outbreak. This comes as Haiti has yet to administer a single shot of coronavirus vaccine. In France, Parisians celebrated new freedoms Wednesday as officials eased coronavirus restrictions, reopening indoor restaurant service from rolling back curfews. COVID-19 cases are plummeting in France, where nearly one in five people are fully vaccinated. In Afghanistan, masked gunmen killed at least 10 workers at a mine-clearing nonprofit in northern Baghlan province Tuesday. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack after the government initially blamed the Taliban. The head of the organization that was attacked, the British-based Halo Trust, said the assailants appeared to be targeting people from the Shia Hazara community. This is a survivor recounting the horrific attack.
They shot two people in the camp compound and then shot at other people inside the room. I was shot in the forehead and fell to the ground, but I got up again and I escaped through the window. 10 people were martyred and 13 or 14 others were injured and have now been taken to the hospital.
In other news from Afghanistan, the Norwegian Refugee Council is warning a severe drought threatens 3 million Afghans who are already vulnerable to years of conflict, food insecurity, and the effects of the pandemic. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports the Pentagon's considering whether to intervene with warplanes or drones if Kabul's in danger of falling to the Taliban after the U.S. completes its withdrawal. Human Rights Watch is calling on the Colombian government to protect human rights and reform its police as ongoing popular protests demanding social reforms, an end to violence and inequality are now in their sixth week. Human Rights Watch says at least 34 people have been killed during protests, at least 20 of those at the hands of the police. The local groups estimate the death toll is far higher. This is union leader Carlos Rivas at a demonstration in Bogota Wednesday.
This is an indolent state. It is a state that does not talk to the people. It talks through force and weapons. We want peace, democracy, life. We don't want a state of terror. We don't want a state where people are murdered, but where there are minimum guarantees. They cannot assassinate the youth or the future of the country.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. will maintain hundreds of sanctions on Iran even if a deal is reached between the two parties to relaunch the Iran nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA.
Even in the event of a return to compliance with the JCPOA, hundreds of sanctions will remain in place, including sanctions imposed by the Trump administration. If they are not inconsistent with the JCPOA, they will remain unless and until Iran's behavior changes.
Iran has said it will not come back into compliance with the agreement which Trump unilaterally withdrew from in 2018 unless the U.S. lifts all sanctions. Talks between Iran and other world powers are set to resume this weekend, just days ahead of Iranian elections Friday. Analysts say the results of the elections could complicate any progress made thus far. As a host of conservative and hardline candidates are vying to succeed President Hassan Rouhani. Attorney General Merrick Garland is supporting the Justice Department's decision to defend former President Trump against a defamation lawsuit brought by a woman who accused Trump of raping her in the 1990s. E. Jean Carroll filed the suit in 2019 after Trump said he would not have assaulted her because, quote, she's not my type. Justice Department lawyers told a federal court this week Trump cannot be held personally liable for the comments since he made them while he was president. Attorney General Garland defended the decision to a Senate committee Wednesday.
The essence of the rule of law is what I said when I accepted the nomination for Attorney General. It is that like cases be treated alike, that there not be one rule for Democrats and another for Republicans. That there not be one rule for friends and another for foes.
E. Jean Carroll blasted the Biden administration for defending Trump, writing in a statement, quote, as women across the country are standing up and holding men accountable for assault, the DOJ is trying to stop me from having that same right. I am angry. I am offended, E. Jean Carroll said. The Canadian company TC Energy says it's canceling construction of the 1,200-mile Keystone XL pipeline, which would have carried over 800,000 barrels of oil each day from Canada's tar sands region across fragile ecosystems in the United States. The announcement came after the Biden administration revoked a key permit for Keystone XL in January and follows years of indigenous-led resistance against the project. The cancellation came on the same day Indigenous water and land defender Jocelyn Charger avoided jail time as she pleaded no contest to trespassing charges for an act of nonviolent civil disobedience against Keystone XL. Another indigenous activist, Oscar High Elk, still faces up to 22 years in prison over what his supporters say are trumped-up charges. Meanwhile, protests continue against construction of the Enbridge Line 3 pipeline. Prosecutors in Minnesota say 179 people were arrested and charged with trespassing after a mass civil disobedience action Monday. Another 68 cited and released for public nuisance and unlawful assembly. In eastern Arizona, fire crews are battling two massive wildfires that have consumed more than 177,000 acres. The fires come as climate scientists say the western United States is suffering the second worst drought in 1,200 years, brought on by a combination of natural dry cycles and human-induced climate change. Lake Mead, the largest freshwater reservoir in the United States along the Colorado River, is less than 36% full. Its lowest level ever. Meanwhile, nearly 2 million people in the San Francisco Bay Area were placed under a water shortage emergency Wednesday as California's drought continues to worsen. A warning to our audience, this next story contains graphic footage and accounts of police violence. The Louisiana State Police unit that killed Ronald Green, a 49-year-old black man, by tasering, punching, and dragging him during an arrest in 2019, is under an internal investigation looking into whether officers are systematically targeting black motorists for abuse. That's according to the Associated Press, which reports investigators are probing the violent arrests of three other black men by the same police unit, one who was punched, stunned, and hoisted to his feet by his hair braids, another who was beaten after he was handcuffed, and yet another who was slammed 18 times with a flashlight. The investigation is focused on white officers with State Police Troop F, a notorious unit in northeastern Louisiana whose officers have mislabeled body camera videos, turned off their cameras during arrests, and otherwise worked to hide evidence from investigators. Some of the troopers already face felony charges. A new report by Public Citizen finds 55 major U.S. corporations that paid no federal taxes last year spent a collective $450 million on political lobbying and campaigns since the 2016 election cycle. The companies also received $3.5 billion in tax rebates. Of the top 25 congressional recipients of the company's money, 20 are Republicans and all voted for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, which lowered the corporate tax rate. FedEx was the biggest spender, followed by Charter Communications, American Electric Power, and Duke Energy. Public Citizen urged Congress to close loopholes allowing for corporate tax avoidance, adding, quote, while paying nothing to support the upkeep of our government, these companies have been spending huge amounts of money to try to keep the game rigged in their favor. The White House revoked three Trump administration executive orders that sought to ban popular social apps TikTok and WeChat from operating in the United States. President Biden issued a new order that would review possible security risks for apps connected to foreign governments, in particular China. This came one day after the Senate passed a $250 billion bill designed to compete with technological, military, and industrial advances out of China. And pressure is growing on the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill to grant tenure to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones. She's best known for producing the 1619 Project with the New York Times, an interactive project that reexamines the legacy of slavery. Her work became the target of right-wing attacks last year after the Trump administration threatened to pull federal funding from schools that use the 1619 Project in their curriculum. Last Friday, a major funding partner of the university joined calls to grant Hannah-Jones tenure, and University of Maryland chemistry professor Lisa Jones declined a job offer by UNC over its refusal to change Hannah-Jones' title. In a solidarity statement, Dr. Jones said, quote, hearing of the delay of Nicole Hannah-Jones' tenure decision led me to reconsider whether the environment at the University of North Carolina would be conducive to achievement of my academic aspirations, which include promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion, she said. In related news, Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed into law the 1836 Project Monday. The name is a reference to the 1619 Project and marks the year Texas seceded from Mexico to evade Mexico's ban on slavery.
The 1836 Project promotes patriotic education about Texas and ensures that the generations to come understand Texas values.
Nicole Hannah-Jones and others responded to the announcement of the 1836 Project by highlighting the fact Texas had fully legalized slavery in its constitution and was guilty at that time of lynching black and Mexican Texans. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. When we come back, as President Biden prepares for the G7 and NATO summits, as well as the summit with Vladimir Putin, we'll look at how the U.S., Russia, and other nuclear-armed nations continue to spend billions on nuclear weapons despite the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll speak with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. Stay with us. People moving in, why? Because of the color of the skin. Run, 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 but you sure can't hide. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Vote for me and I'll set you free. Rap on, brother, rap on. Well, the only person talking about love, man, brother, is the preacher. And it seems teacher. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, humiliation, obligation to my nation. All the children, that's what the world is today. Hey. The cell appeals are at an all-time high. Young folks walking around with their heads in the sky. Cities aflame in the summertime. That's what the world is today by the Temptations. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
President Biden's begun his first European trip as president. After meeting British Prime Minister Boris Johnson today, Biden will take part in the G7 leaders meeting in Cornwall, then head to the NATO summit in Brussels. He'll end his trip in Geneva, where he'll meet Russian President Vladimir Putin June 16th. On Wednesday, President Biden addressed U.S. Air Force personnel stationed in Britain.
We're not seeking conflict with Russia. We want a stable, predictable relationship. Our two nations share incredible responsibilities, and among them, ensuring strategic stability and upholding arms control agreements. I take that responsibility seriously. But I've been clear, the United States will respond in a robust and meaningful way when the Russian government engages in harmful activities.
The Biden-Putin summit comes just weeks after the Biden administration announced it would not rejoin the Open Skies Treaty, a major international arms control deal signed by the George H.W. Bush administration in 1992. Vladimir Putin then announced Russia would withdraw as well. As a presidential candidate, Joe Biden criticized Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the treaty. In May 2020, Biden said Trump has doubled down on his short-sighted policy of going it alone and abandoning American leadership. Biden is also continuing a number of Trump's initiatives to expand the U.S. nuclear arsenal. In his new budget, President Biden is seeking $43 billion for nuclear weapons, including money to develop a new submarine-launched nuclear cruise missile, which as a candidate he described as a bad idea. Meanwhile, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, has just published a report revealing a global spending on nuclear weapons increased by $1.4 billion last year, despite the pandemic. The report found the world's nine nuclear-armed countries spent $72.6 billion on nuclear weapons in 2020. That amounts to nearly $138,000 every minute. The United States spent by far the most, $37 billion, three times more than the next country, China, which spent $10 billion. Russia was next at $8 billion, followed by the United Kingdom, France, India, Israel, Pakistan, and North Korea. ICANN released this short video to accompany its new report.
$72.6 billion. That's how much the nine nuclear-armed states spent on nuclear weapons in 2020. Taxpayer money during the worst global pandemic in a century, financing weapons of mass destruction. Although most countries support a global ban on nuclear weapons, these countries and companies spend billions to keep nuclear weapons in business. $72.6 billion for government agencies and private companies that build nuclear weapons. These companies fund major think tanks that write about nuclear weapons and hire lobbyists to make sure policymakers approve enormous nuclear weapon budgets the next year. This is the nuclear weapon funding cycle, a shadowy interplay between governments, private companies, think tanks, and lobbyists, all complicit in today's massive stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. It's time to stop the cycle. It's time for the ban.
That little report produced by ICANN. We're joined now by Alicia Sanders-Zachary, Policy and Research Coordinator for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. The organization won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017 for its work on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Alicia is the co-author of the new report, Complicit, 2020 Global Nuclear Weapons Spending. So you have a world where the wealthiest countries cannot find the means to inoculate the world, to get the vaccines necessary for the world to be protected from COVID-19, but are spending billions on nuclear weapons. Talk about how the whole system works. Talk about your report, Alicia.
Yes, well, thank you so much for having me on and for sharing the report. You know, last year we did a report just on how much countries spent on nuclear weapons. We did the methodology to provide that estimate, which hasn't been done very much in the past. And this year we wanted to show more of the big picture. Why is it that nine countries are spending more than $70 billion on their nuclear weapons in the middle of a global pandemic? And so we looked at all of the pieces of the puzzle and the flow of money, the cycle of spending on weapons of mass destruction in just 1 year. And it's pretty shocking. We saw after those countries decided to spend $72.6 billion on their nuclear weapons, they gave out billions of dollars, over $27 billion in contracts to the defense companies that build and maintain these weapons. And then those companies kept spending money to make sure that they kept getting money in years to come. So they spent over $117 million lobbying policymakers to increase spending on defense. And they also spent up to $10 million funding almost all of the major think tanks that research and write about nuclear weapons. So these are all of the actors, all of the players in this dirty nuclear weapons business that we wanted to highlight and start to hold accountable.
Alicia, you mentioned the companies. Could you name them and tell us how much money they made off these contracts?
Absolutely. So in the report, we feature all of the more than 20 companies that are currently involved in producing nuclear weapons. So a lot of these companies have existing contracts that they're still fulfilling on nuclear weapons. But in 2020, 11 of those companies received new or modified contracts to work on existing or new nuclear weapon systems, amounting to a total of more than $27 billion. And there are, you know, a number of companies involved, just to name a few. Of course, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Honeywell International is one not a lot of people might know about. The full list of all those companies and their amounts are in the report. So if you want more details, I'd recommend checking that out.
Now, Lishay, despite the fact that, as you document, the U.S. spent over $37 billion on nuclear arms in the last year, that figure is expected to exponentially increase, according to the Congressional Budget Office, in the coming year because of technological upgrades to the nuclear arsenal in the U.S. Could you talk about what we know about forthcoming increases in nuclear spending here?
Absolutely. So we've been seeing, I mean, from year to year, the spending on nuclear weapons has been increasing. As was mentioned, there was an increase in $1.4 billion on these weapons, even in the middle of a global pandemic. And we know that that number is just going to continue to increase because of a recent report by the Congressional Budget Office looking at 10-year nuclear weapons costs, which found that there would be an increase of $140 billion over those 10 years compared to a previous 2019 report. So, you know, despite Biden's campaign promises of wanting to work for arms control, wanting to work for disarmament, we're seeing that in reality, he's going full steam ahead with Trump's legacy nuclear weapons programs and continuing to spend more money on these weapons of mass destruction.
Can you talk, Alicia Sanders-Zachary, about the significance? I mean, he's going to meet with the G7 countries and what do nuclear weapons have to do with those countries? And then the NATO summit and the report you put out ahead of the summit, ICAN is arguing that members of the Transatlantic Alliance should embrace the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which entered into force in January. So talk about how these two summits are critical to nuclear weapons and somehow turning the escalation of them around.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking of the NATO summit in particular, we saw, you know, President Biden wrote in an opinion piece to the Washington Post recently that a real focus of this trip was to promote democratic values and to bring the power of democracy to these meetings. And I think that's very relevant when it comes to nuclear weapons issues in NATO countries and in Europe, because as this other report shows that we just released today, in most countries across NATO, there is overwhelming support for the country to join the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons when you ask the people what they think. But despite popular opinion, democratic support for this treaty for banning nuclear weapons, these governments continue to say that they don't support the treaty, refuse to join it. And this is a NATO position that's really not in line with their democratic values and democratic ideals. So I think this is an opportunity for NATO to really reevaluate, their stance as a democracy that listens to what the people want on key issues like nuclear weapons.
Alicia, could you talk about the extent to which, if at all, the Biden administration has departed from the Trump administration on nuclear weapons policy?
I think so far we really haven't seen a departure. And this is clear in the recent 2022 budget request, which, as you've mentioned in the introduction, keeps and continues to fund, Trump's additional nuclear weapons programs, as well as kind of the programs of record. So we really need to see more action from President Biden. I think, this upcoming meeting with President Putin is an opportunity for both countries to recognize the increasing risk of nuclear weapons, the devastating humanitarian consequences of these weapons, and take real steps and tangible progress towards nuclear disarmament and towards joining the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Not only the issue of what would happen if a nuclear weapon was used, and of course that would be just devastating, but the fact that the money does not go, for example, to dealing with this global pandemic. I wanted to ask you about the report also naming think tanks which receive funding from nuclear weapons manufacturers. The list includes the Atlantic Council, Brookings Institution, Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Center for New American Security, Center for Strategic and International Studies, Hudson Institute, and the International Institute of Strategic Studies. Can you talk more about the role of think tanks and these nuclear corporations?
Absolutely. This is really new, I think, shocking research in that it shows that upwards of 10 in just 1 year, the companies that produce and work on nuclear weapons spent upwards of $10 million funding really almost all major think tanks that are writing and researching about nuclear weapons. And, you know, it's not always possible to know exactly the extent of the influence of this funding. But what's really concerning is, I think, the depth and how widespread this funding is. It's not just one think tank. As I said, it's really most of the think tanks that are doing substantial work on nuclear weapons. And I think it's a systemic problem in the field that, you know, think tanks should be asking themselves how can we actually come together and address the perhaps undue influence of nuclear weapon producing companies in this field, in this sector.
As the Biden administration pours billions into developing new nuclear weapons, nuclear resistors are still going to prison for opposing U.S. nuclear policy. On Wednesday, Mark Colville, a member of the Kings Bay Plowshares 7, reported to prison. He was sentenced in April to 21 months in prison, breaking into the Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base April 4, 2018, on the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. Colville and six other activists entered the base armed with hammers, crime scene tape, baby bottles containing their own blood, and an indictment charging the U.S. government with crimes against peace. Two other members of the Kings Bay Plowshares 7, Martha Hennessy and Carmen Trotta, were recently released from prison. Martha Hennessy is the granddaughter of Dorothy Day, one of the founders of the Catholic Worker Movement. Your final comments on the role of activism when it comes to nuclear weapons.
I think it's absolutely essential. You know, at the end of the day, these are weapons of mass destruction, and they've now been made illegal under the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons due to the collaborative work of activists and diplomats and scientists and researchers and people all around the world. And so it's really, we really need activism to change the status quo and to finally get rid of these weapons of mass destruction.
Alicia Sanders-Zachary, want to thank you so much for being with us, policy and research coordinator for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And we'll link to the report, Complicit, 2020 Global Nuclear Weapons Spending, as we continue to cover in the coming days the G7, the NATO summit, the summit with President Biden and President Putin. Next up is President Biden pledges to buy half a billion vaccine doses to give to almost 100 countries in the world. We'll look at why many Americans are refusing to get vaccinated. We'll speak with Dr. Sira Madad of NYC Health and Hospitals, the nation's largest public health care system, and why health care workers, a number of them, are saying no. Stay with us.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
Ring of Fire by Johnny Cash. People in parts of northern hemisphere, and particularly in the northeast United States, were able to see a ring of fire in the sky this morning as an annular solar eclipse moved across part of the planet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Well, in the coming days, President Biden is expected to engage in vaccine diplomacy at the G7 summit in the UK and announce a vaccine plan for the world. Reporters asked Biden about the plan as he left for the first foreign trip of his presidency.
Is the president, do you expect to come out with a vaccine strategy for the world?
I have one and I'll be announcing it. Thank you.
Today, President Biden will announce the United States plans to buy 500 million doses of Pfizer's COVID vaccine to donate to more than 90 countries. His administration is also negotiating with Moderna. Health experts warn vaccination inequity could prolong the pandemic if the coronavirus continues to mutate, possibly making it more infectious and resistant to vaccines. This comes as many Americans are refusing to get vaccinated, and thousands, if not millions, of Johnson & Johnson shots will expire soon, including some 200,000 doses of the vaccine in Ohio alone. Top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci acknowledged Tuesday the U.S. is struggling to meet Biden's goal of vaccinating 70% of Americans by July 4th.
There are some states that are falling well below the 50%. And those are the states that we are, in many respects, I use the word, almost pleading with them on the basis of what I showed in my presentation just a few minutes ago of why it is so important to get vaccinated. And if we can galvanize that group that still, for one reason or other, does not want to get vaccinated, we can reach the 70 and go well beyond it as we get into the summer.
Meanwhile, in Texas, Houston Methodist Hospital has suspended 178 staff members who refuse to abide by its mandate that employees be fully vaccinated by Monday. It's one of the first hospitals to require vaccinations. Workers have filed a lawsuit alleging the policy violates their rights. They spoke to ABC 13 during a protest Monday.
I'm not willing to risk my life to save my job, but I do love what I do. I love Houston Methodist, and it's unfortunate that they're willing to let us go over something like this instead of giving us more time.
We're all suspended right now, so he can choose to let us go back to work, but if he doesn't and we get fired, we're going on to the Supreme Court for a wrongful termination lawsuit.
The lawsuit by the Methodist employees was filed by a conservative lawyer and activist. The case is being closely watched by other hospitals employers nationwide. On Wednesday, many hospitals in Washington, D.C. and Maryland announced they'll soon start requiring employees to be vaccinated. For more, we're joined by Dr. Sira Madad, an infectious disease epidemiologist who leads the Special Pathogens Program for NYC Health and Hospitals, the nation's largest public health care system. She recently wrote an opinion piece published in the New York Times headlined, "Why Are So Many of My Fellow Health Workers Unvaccinated?" So let's start there, Dr. Madad. We had you on toward the beginning of the pandemic. You've worked throughout. It might surprise people to know that the first people offered the vaccine, healthcare workers, the surprising percentage of them across the country that are saying no to vaccines. What have you found is the reason, and what do you think needs to be done?
You know, the healthcare workers haven't offered the COVID-19 vaccine starting December. So it's been an uncomfortable reality to see that, you know, we are now in June and, you know, nearly 50% of healthcare workers remain unvaccinated, unprotected. And so this is certainly a dilemma, not just here in the United States, but around the world. Some of the reasons that we found that healthcare workers are hesitant are the same reasons we find in the general public. And this is the newness of the vaccines or the long-term side effects. And so when we talk about vaccine hesitancy, we need to address it in all of its forms and facets for healthcare workers along with the general public. The strategies and the tactics continue, which includes education, but it also includes making strong recommendations for everybody to get vaccinated. The one thing that I'll mention, and we're seeing it around the world, obviously the COVID-19 pandemic is far from over, But one of the greatest threats to our current vaccination program here domestically and around the world is not just vaccine hesitancy and the slow rollout, you know, that we're seeing around the world. It's the emergence of variants that's going to threaten our vaccine-induced immunity. And so we need to not only work on getting people vaccinated that are hesitant, but also look at it from those that are, you know, not vaccinated and the variants that are circulating. So we need to look at it from both fronts.
Dr. Madad, could you say more, differentiate between the different kinds of healthcare workers, those who are more likely to receive the vaccine and those who are more hesitant or have outright refused to do so?
Absolutely. So the term healthcare worker is a fully loaded term. And what I mean by that is there's many different types of healthcare workers. You know, you have the full gamut from providers like doctors and nurses to support staff. You know, this could be medical assistants. These could be individuals like home health aides. So when you talk about home healthcare workers, you look at it from a standpoint of those that, for example, provide diagnosis and treatment to patients like doctors and nurses. And about 7 out of 10 are vaccinated. So a large chunk of individuals that are providers and nurses are vaccinated. But when you look into those that are healthcare workers that provide more administrative support or, you know, help with bathing or feeding patients, about 4 in 10, you know, are vaccinated. So there is a stark divide between, you know, within healthcare workers and the various categories as well. And then this also relates to educational level. So as I mentioned, difference in occupation, but also those that are less educated are more, you know, hesitant to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Additional kind of areas that we've seen generally around the United States is, you know, race, ethnicity also matters in terms of, you know, accepting the COVID-19 vaccine, your political affiliation. So these are all different types of factors that go into the decision to get vaccinated.
The fact that you mentioned earlier, and of course we know the widespread phenomenon of variants, most recently the Delta variant, which was first identified in India. And the only way, as many medical professionals say, yourself included, that the only way to make sure that people are safe from these variants is by getting vaccinated. Do you think there should be a vaccine mandate, not just in hospitals and healthcare facilities, but also, for example, in schools with teachers, students, and anyone really who's in interacting regularly with the public?
I do think my personal opinion is that anyone that, you know, has a public-facing occupation or role that comes in contact with other individuals, there should be a mandate to get vaccinated. Nobody has a right to spread a deadly, highly infectious disease to other people. We still have a large population, both here in the United States and around the world, that are vulnerable to infection. And now that we're talking about these variants, like the Delta variant that is, you know, said to be more transmissible, over 40 to 50% more transmissible than the B.1.1.7 or the Alpha variant, which was already more transmissible to begin with, you know, the original, you know, virus strain. We're looking at individuals that are not vaccinated are now at higher risk of getting infection, of succumbing to disease and requiring hospitalization. So we need to make sure that we're looking at it from that lens. And so we want to, you know, do a much, much better job here domestically and around the world to get more people vaccinated. And this also includes, you know, I think when we look at the global equitable, sharing of COVID-19 vaccines, the U.S. certainly is not absent from it. In fact, the U.S. is one of the leading countries that is supporting equitable vaccine distribution. And you've seen, you know, President Biden's recent announcement of providing, you know, tens of millions of Pfizer vaccines to many different countries. And so it's time that other countries also step up, because the World Health Organization has mentioned that we need about 11 billion vaccines to vaccinate about 70% of the population around the world. And only as of today, we've only administered over 2 billion. And so we need to make sure that we're in a phase of this pandemic where when we look at now these vaccines made available, these life-saving preventative vaccines, they need to go into arms of people around the world if we are to truly end this pandemic for everybody.
Before we go to the rest of the world, can we stay in your own family? Because you begin your New York Times op-ed saying in April of last year, I, along with my entire family, my husband, my three children, in-laws, and at least one of our four home health aides came down with COVID-19. Can you talk about what happened? So often one family is a microcosm of what happens in the world, but here you are an epidemiologist who is leading the New York City response. And explain how the whole issue of vaccine hesitancy, talking to the home health care aides, how you believe you came down with it.
Well, you know, I think no one is, when we talk about the virus, it's ubiquitous and anybody can get infected. And even when you are applying these preventative measures, these risk reduction measures, there's still a chance of getting infected if there's a slip up, And so here in my own household early on last year, it was hard to see who brought the virus into our home. Many of us have occupations where we're in hospitals, where we're interacting with many different people, and our home health aides that we have four of that care for, a family member that requires assistance around the clock, they were living in some of the hardest hit areas that were experiencing very high volumes of infection of COVID-19. So back in April, we started to have all of us come down with this disease, and it was probably one of the most frightening experiences of my life. And I responded to multiple different infectious disease outbreaks, from Ebola to Zika to measles to many others. And so this has been certainly one of the experiences where it involved my family, my children. And so when we look at the early days and how I responded to it at home, it was very similar to how I was looking at it from a hospital standpoint. I was standing up protocols and processes to ensure that we were limiting transmission to one another. This includes opening windows and having less people in the kitchen or areas where we're congregating more. But it was definitely, it was a challenge. And somebody like myself, who's knowledgeable, who's an, ID epidemiologist, it was a challenge for me. So I can just imagine what was happening in other households. And that's where it was starting. But now that we're in a phase where we have vaccinations available, my four home health aides, many of them remain reluctant. They don't want to get vaccinated, even though they, many of them experienced COVID-19. They know the complications. They saw it firsthand, what was happening in New York City. And so I've been working actively since, December, when these vaccines have been made available, and home health aides were eligible starting January. And as of today, we have two that are fully vaccinated and two that are, one that made an appointment and one that's completely on the fence. And so, it's these conversations that I have with them on an ongoing basis. And so when I talk to them about the vaccines, it's a lot with, responding with empathy and caring and not being judgmental, asking them what their concerns are and providing tailored information. And I do that on an ongoing basis. I feel like it's probably almost every day that I speak to those that are not vaccinated to encourage them to make that informed decision and providing them with the benefits of why vaccination is important for them and their family and their community, especially with the variant circulating. But these are not one-and-done conversations. And so it's one thing to have these conversations on an ongoing basis, but it's another to mandate it as a condition of employment. And that's what you're seeing many employers and many healthcare systems are starting to implement, personally is a decision, as I mentioned, that I think mandating it is the way to go.
Well, earlier this month, Africa's CDC director, John Nkengasong, said in an interview that people on the continent are watching in amazement as Americans turn down vaccines.
This is a continent of 1.2 billion people, but as we speak today, less than 2% of our population has been immunized. We are desperate to get more vaccines, and we can see that the continent is eager to get more vaccines, to get vaccinated. We are watching what is going on in the U.S. with total amazement, and we really hope that the partnership with the President Biden will help us and enable us to roll out our vaccines acquisition and vaccination in a timely fashion.
That's Dr. John Nkengasong, the director of Africa's CDC, and you can go to democracynow.org for our several interviews with him. And this is White House coronavirus advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci talking earlier this month about people in the U.S. refusing vaccines.
You know, one of the real ironic things are that we have people in the rest of the world, in India, in South America, in Southern Africa, who are pleading for vaccines because they don't have enough doses. We have more doses than we need in this country. What a shame and a tragedy that we don't make use of something that is for our benefit when others throughout the world would do anything to have what we have.
So, Dr. Sirimaddad, what do you endorse? We have the situation now where there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Johnson & Johnson vaccines that are going to go bad throughout the United States in the next few weeks because they're just not being used in states. Then you have some of the wealthiest countries in the world, not the United States now, opposing this WTO waiver, that drug companies will have to share the recipes so that other drug companies that don't invent the vaccine but have the capacity to make the vaccine can get these vaccines around the world. And now you have President Biden today announcing a half a billion vaccines to over 90 of the poorest countries in the world. What needs to happen? How is it that we have these vaccines that are about to expire and you have just to the south of us, Mexico, begging us for vaccines?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to it. First, you know, these surges are happening right now, and so it behooves us to make sure that we are taking the surplus vaccines that we have here in the U.S. and donating it to countries that are in need, and we need to be very strategic about it. So certainly we want to provide vaccines to the entire world, but right now we have countries that are experiencing surges. We have countries that are on the precipice of experiencing surges. So if we're strategic about where we're providing the vaccines right now, we would help avert many more deaths in the future. So with the J&J vaccine, you know, that we have many that are looking to expire this month, you know, I think there is a game plan from the federal government to look at it and see if we can use it here domestically or send it internationally. So I think the Biden administration is doing that what they can. And they are looking at this closely. It's not as if they are oblivious of what's not happening. And so I think it's just important to probably note that they are looking at it and they are seeing what they can do about these, you know, vaccines that are about to expire with the J&J. With that said, and as I mentioned, right now the game plan should be, you know, providing the surplus vaccines to countries around the world because the pandemic is happening right now. But on top of that, we need to look at with the transfer of the, you know, and the waiver of the intellectual property, patents is just one obstacle. It's more of transferring the technology and the capacity and the capability to actually manufacture vaccines. But that's not going to happen overnight. I mean, it takes some time to develop these companies that can manufacture COVID-19 vaccines. And so that needs to also happen in parallel because we know this pandemic is something that's going to go on, you know, for the foreseeable future. And so while we're providing the vaccines right now as a stopgap, we can also make sure that they have not just the recipe, but the technology and the infrastructure that they need to actually develop their own vaccines. It's like giving individuals a fruit for now, but then giving them a seed to grow it in the future. And that's exactly what we need. You know, so I think that we are in a better position, but certainly we just have to work very fast because, as we know, this virus is very fast and it's happening all around the world with us right now.
And Dr. Maddad, indeed, you know, here in the U.S., because despite obviously there are levels of, you know, numbers of people who are not receiving the vaccine, the virus is abating here and, you know, the country is opening up. But in much of the rest of the world or in many parts of the world, the pandemic and its effects are worse now than they were last year, including in India and many parts of Latin America as well. So if I could just ask, do you think here in the U.S., given the almost absurd levels of incentives that are now being offered to people who are vaccine hesitant, in your experience, are you seeing more of those people now receiving the vaccine? I mean, they're being offered everything from millions of dollars in lottery prizes, and most remarkably in West Virginia, officials offering a chance to win rifles for those who agree to take the vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, first, I'm baffled, right? I'm baffled at the fact that we have to give Americans money and incentives to take a life-saving preventative vaccine that billions of people around the world are dying for. It's just really, really sad to see, you know, the current state of affairs that we are in, and over 30% of Americans remain unvaccinated. And so, you know, I think that individuals are getting vaccinated, but it has slowed down quite a bit as we're seeing, you know, only about 1.3 million shots are going into arms every day, which, you know, is one of the lowest that we've been. It's been over a 50% decrease since the peak of vaccination in April. And so we're very slow in terms of those that are in that wait and see category that are getting vaccinated. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of us are working very hard to address individuals that are vaccine hesitant to get them to the right of accepting the vaccines. But it's not going to happen overnight. And we need to just continue to chip away at it. This is not something that's going to go away just, you know, within the next week. You can offer them $1 million, but that's not going to be enough for many individuals that, you know, don't want to get the COVID-19 vaccine. So we certainly need to continue with our creativity and our innovation to get more Americans, you know, vaccinated. At the same time, we have a global fire of a virus, you know, raging around the world. And so we need to continue to work globally to ensure that these vaccines are getting to where they need to go if Americans don't want them. We need to continue to work on both fronts. And as of May of this year, 75% of the COVID-19 doses were being administered in only 10 countries, including the United States. There are countries in Africa that have less than 1% of their population vaccinated, whereas here in the United States, we have over 50% or about 64% actually now that received one dose. So we need to make sure that we're looking at it from a lens of there are Americans that, you know, are hesitant. We need to continue to work at, you know, work with them to have them make more informed decisions. But at the same time, we need to take our surplus vaccines and continue to donate it, which is happening right now with the Biden administration. So that's not a, it's not one of those things where it's if and then or us or the, or us versus them. It's these types of, you know, issues that we need to work, you know, concurrently, and we need to continue to chip away at it because these are longstanding issues. Vaccine hesitancy is not something new. It hasn't been new for this COVID-19 vaccine. It's been around for decades. I responded to the measles epidemic we had here in New York City in 2018. And I saw full swing the vaccine hesitancy and the anti-vax group come out. And so we've seen this. And in fact, the World Health Organization has called vaccine hesitancy one of the top 10 global health threats around the world many years ago. So this is not, it's not a new phenomena, but we just need to continue to work at it because we want to make sure we're protecting all people from getting infected with COVID-19. And now that we have this life-saving vaccine, that we need to ensure that more people understand that this is the benefit for them and those around them and to end this pandemic sooner for all of us.
Dr. Madad, one of the reasons that's given here in the U.S. for people refusing the vaccine is the fact that the three vaccines that are in use here still only have emergency use authorization by the FDA. When do you expect the vaccines to be fully authorized, and what's holding that up?
So both Moderna and Pfizer have submitted for full approval to the FDA. It's an entire process that is followed, and it can take a few months for the FDA to go through all the data. But I think the important part is the step has been taken to get the full approval. And many Americans, if you look at the survey, you know, they do feel this because this is an emergency authorized vaccine. If once it's fully approved, that may be another incentive for them to get vaccinated. So we're going to probably see many more Americans get vaccinated once that full approval is given by the FDA. But it does take some time. But the good thing is that that step has been taken with both Pfizer and Moderna. So within the next, you know, couple of months, we may see the approval come through. And what this will also mean is that these companies can now advertise on TV. They can directly, you know, contact consumers to get vaccinated. Right now, they can't do that with the emergency authorization that they have. So we'll see much more of marketing promotion of these vaccines once they're approved, and we'll see probably more Americans wanting to get vaccinated based on survey results because they're waiting for that approval.
Dr. Sarah Madad, now the companies are looking at younger and younger children. Already now 12 on up for Moderna and Pfizer, and now Moderna is looking at, I think, from 6 months on up. Can you talk about some of the complications that children are having right now as the hospitalization goes down for those who are vaccinated and deaths go down in the United States? For children, some of those hospitalizations are going up.
Well, that's exactly correct. So what we're seeing is that, you know, many adults are now fully vaccinated, and when we're looking at adolescents, they're still vulnerable, you know, and the virus is still out there. It's still circulating in our communities, in our neighborhoods, within our families. And so you're seeing now the virus is trying to find somebody to infect, and you have adolescents that are still vulnerable, that are not vaccinated. So you're seeing a higher number of those groups, you know, get infected, requiring hospitalization. While we are seeing lower cases generally of severe illness and death associated with it, you are seeing more cases of the younger population getting infected. And that's why it's important for the adolescents that are 12 and older to get vaccinated. you know, it's not just because of a risk to themselves and the long, and the implications of long COVID, but they can still harbor the virus and spread it to others that are vulnerable. And so to give an example, we have, you know, about 3 to 4% of the American population that are, you know, immunocompromised. You know, they may be taking immunosuppressants or, you know, organ transplant recipients, many others that fall under this bucket. And while they're vaccinated, you know, they don't have, you know, a great, robust immune response. They have a suboptimal, you know, immune response, so they're still vulnerable to infection. And so we want to make sure that, you know, the adolescents are also looking to get vaccinated. It's important for us to reach the threshold of the community immunity.
But Dr. Sarah Madad, thank you so much for being with us, New York City epidemiologist.
Here in New York City, you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. We're listener-sponsored, commercial-free radio, 61 years of commercial-free broadcasting, thanks to listeners just like you. Visit our website, WBAI.org, and consider becoming a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. That's WBAI.org, or call our pledge line. It's open 24 hours a day. That number is 212-222-222.